Now we come to the lecture of November the 3rd, 1906. Rudolf Steiner starts. You all know the place in the Gospel of John, which says, law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. If you consider this a little bit more, how Christ Jesus brings his personality in contrast to the occurrences in the desert. He says, your fathers have eaten manna in the desert, but in the bread of the desert your fathers died. I give you another bread. I am the bread of life. Moses gave the bread in the desert. Christ gives the bread of life. Now, I ask you to remember again how the four members of the human being have developed themselves at different times. The ego entered as consciousness only towards the end of the Atlantean period. It was only in our fifth root race the capacity, the manus capacity appeared. One, when the ancient Indian period, manus appeared inwardly in the sentient body. In the primal Persians, manus entered into the sentient soul. In the Egyptians, manus entered into the intellectual or gemut soul. Let's be clear to ourselves what that means. The Egyptian priests considered the stars differently from the way in which present-day astronomers considered the stars. The Egyptian priests saw in the stars living, spirit-ensouled worlds. When they spoke of the planet Mercury, with that they didn't mean something mere, purely of a material nature, but they meant the spirit of Mercury, just as we do it when we call a human being with a certain name. The movement of the stars, the starry script, to them was the expression of a spiritual element. That is manasic knowledge, a permeation of the cosmic space with thoughts. What the Chaldean predecessors limited themselves to heavenly occurrences, the Chaldean priests restricted themselves to cosmic occurrences, cosmic situations. The Egyptian wise people, on the other hand, took that in the service more and more of earthly situations and animal requirements. They placed the manasic being in the service of materiality. Just consider this very well. Take note of this. An example for that is the construction of the Meris Lake. With that, the Egyptians organized a reservoir in order to regulate the flooding of the Nile. The construction, all the agriculture of the whole of Egypt followed as a result of manasic knowledge. Manasic, that means pure spiritual. Manasic beings were placed in the service of the highest human requirements. That's just the characteristic of the intellectual soul, that it utilizes the manasic wisdom and attempts to satisfy with it the drives and passions. Today is this development the Egyptian darkness, the Manas darkening still further proceeded. But is the difference between the great events of today so differently? Is it very much different if man meals bread between two stones, or if he gets it by a cable to New York? The name Kama Manus is given to such a union of cosmic beings with animal, earthly, material goals. Ancient religions would have looked upon the accomplishments of our technology, our merchandising, and our businesses with very mixed feelings. An impurification of holy things, they would have regarded it, if the human being put his highest spiritual capacity in the service of lower nature requirements. This was much worse than its pure instinct, which the animal didn't do much better. It was perceived as a decay, a misuse of the higher tasks of manas. It was considered a deterioration, a decay of the spirit of itself. This abfall, this defection, expressed itself in a remarkable naming, namely Egypt. When the term Egypt was used, it was not referred to the land of Egypt, but the designation is the symbol for such a decay, such a falling away. Because in Egypt, this abfall, this falling away, occurred first in the greatest degree. The word Egypt is thus not the designation of the land meant here, but definite soul conditions of the blinding of manas, where the higher nature was placed in the service of the lower nature. This is not intended to be a criticism, but to be a depiction of historical facts which people felt about. Manas first descended down into the lower kingdoms and forces, in order then to rise up again, to come higher again to its own original nature. So you can say that Egypt is also the mother womb of monastic evolution. Within Egypt, however, there arises the folk which is called upon to, so to say, purify manas. In the biblical accounts, this is very interestingly presented in the history of the people of Israel and of the great mission of Moses in the people of Israel. Moses signifies manas, and the exodus of the Jews out of Egypt is the historical repetition of the exodus of manas out of the Egyptian sinking in to of the manas into Kama. In the first place, the folk Israel had to go to Egypt in order to there receive the impulse to its work. The exodus out of Egypt, that is the picture for that particular moment when manas in Egypt fell into the darkness and became a desert. What is necessary for that? For that, Moses himself must show for his person that which Manus is capable of. More than to serve the bodily requirements, he must demonstrate his state-forming force. Moses must become the lawgiver of Israel and create in the folk his law, insert the law into the people. The Ten Commandments were necessary as a witness of an instrument of Moses. They are the paraphrases of the birth of Manus. In them, there must be worked upon the consciousness in order that you could begin the rising up Manus consciousness. The most significant expression this Manus consciousness receives there, where the Lord in the burning thorn bush says to Moses, "I am the I am, tell that to the Jews." This is the birth of Manus in self-consciousness. Now the thing will concern itself that the God in his spirituality should be grasped, the God which announces itself in the inner being should be held really holy. A law is something of a much higher nature, and the God Jehovah speaks to the people and he says, "I am the Lord your God who led you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods beside me." However, the people did make themselves an image and worshipped the golden calf, although they were forbidden to build make such a picture, and they weren't allowed to misuse the name. God wanted to be a pictureless God. A God for the Jews would be something without form. If we want to really understand this whole process much more exactly, so now I must point to something else. The ego has a definite evolutionary development in mankind. In order that the ego should be able to arise, there the developing human body had to transform itself in many aspects. Let's make it clear to us in a diagram. When in the late Atlantean period the consciousness arose in the region of the present-day Ireland, these two points, A and B, came together within the human skull, head. One point represented the center point of the physical head, and the other point represented the center point of the etheric head. Previously, before consciousness in early Atlantean, these two points were separated. But when the consciousness arose, these two points united themselves within the human head. The coinciding of both these points, the drawing in of the ether head into the skull, that is the transition from human beings without bones to human beings with bones. In the Lemurian period, man lived only his ether existence. In the Lemurian period, man led a sort of etheric existence. The descent upon the physical plane consisted in the forming of a solid bodily kernel of bones. Solid, independent, after he became inwardly solidified, the man also should become externally solidified as a reflection of such spiritual qualities. With that, it signifies the transition from the boneless to the bony human being, and that gave the physical corporeal possibility for consciousness. Very interesting is a looking out into the future in order to make clear what I've just said. In millions of years, the further development in the soft parts of the human being have very little changed. In the future millions of years, the further development in the soft parts of the human beings will have changed very little. The soul itself will more and more solidify itself. Compare what I said yesterday about the future of the heart. Just as a iron, wonderful machine filled with enormous force, will the human being then carry his body as an instrument through which he will be able to work. He'll carry about his body with him as an instrument through which he'll be able to work as an iron, as a wonderful machine. Man will become free of his organism. The soul will dominate the human being from the outside, as occurs today during the sleep period. Man will be independent of his organism, but will rule it just as a machine. The development of bone as a principle with that is immensely of value. Hence, the ancient religious writings said, "Preserve your bony system. Do not break your bones." The symbolic expression for this was given in Egypt in the inserted sacrifice to the memory of the saving from destruction of the firstborn of the Egyptians. But here he means that the Israelites were saved when the firstborn of the Egyptians were destroyed. To the external sign, a lamb was supposed to be eaten, and very indicative of these words, "You shall break no bone of the lamb." So on the place where there inserted itself the freeing through manas, this importance of the bone formation is explicitly indicated in this ritual prescription for the paschal lamb. And with the greatest lamb, the representative of mankind, with the Christ Jesus, it was not done as was done with all the other crucified people. The bones were not broken. It says, "Do not break his bones." Thus the Jews were led out of Egypt. We shall see if our grasping of the Bible expresses this more exactly. Indeed, it does express it word for word. This is one of the great accomplishments of spiritual science, to be able to read the word-for-word meaning of that which is given in the religious documents about ancient symbolic activities. The people of Israel goes into the desert. What is the desert? When the ego sinks into itself in order to seek for the God in itself, then it must enter into the desert, into the loneliness. And in this desert, man must cause an awakening of the manas in himself to enliven the manas in this desert. There, The people wake up in the morning and it sees the manna which has fallen from heaven. It sees the fields white and asks the question, Manu, what is that? This is the question which man always places when he wants to achieve knowledge. Manus, manna, bread in the wilderness, the wilderness food of the Jews. Manus, the pure sense-free thinking, the heavenly food which only falls in the desert. So there places itself in the desert the falling of manna as representing the descent there of the pure manus. The Jewish people is the carrier of manus. The Jewish people has the task of carrying manus into mankind. Now, in order to achieve a more exact understanding, let us now touch with a few words another one of the seven inexpressible mysteries, namely the fourth mystery, that of birth and death. Birth and death, what are they in the occult sense? One must make it clear to oneself. They are always of necessity united with life. Just think back to the pre-Lemurian periods, before man descended into coarse physical materiality. Man at that time was a person incorporated in etheric material. That was his coarsest substance, the ether. The ether was his coarsest substance. His contemporaries in the physical world were the animal body. So that we in the pre-Lemurian time have the ether body of the human being, which condensed itself to physical air. The ether body sank itself down, einstaubt it itself. In the later Lemurian time, it einstaubt itself, inserted itself into the physical earth body. This is the moment in the biblical story of creation when it's presented with the words, and God blew into the human being his breath, and man became a living soul. With the breath, we draw in actually into ourselves our ether body. The ether man had condensed itself right to the air, to air, when its connection with the earth body was to be executed. And he drew in to the lungs. With every breath of air, we actually factually draw into ourselves our ether body. The whole way and kind of life was in the early Lemurians quite different from that of the later periods. Out of his ether body, the only thing which he had, the separated itself continuously out of himself and drew into itself new ether substances. There was an interchange of ether substances, a separation of ether substances and a drawing in of new ether substances. Renewal and expulsion occurred. There occurred also continuously intensive changes corresponding to the higher fineness of the ether body. This occurred continuously without the distinct interchange of birth and death. Thus, there never occurred birth and death, only a sort of transformation. The dying and becoming born, that could only occur when the ether body inserted itself into materiality. Birth and death, spoken of exactly, is a changing of a condition of consciousness. Death can and must also only enter there where a soul lives in a body which is foreign to it, strange to it, and utilizes strange foreign organs. The earlier life content of the soul dissolves itself away when the physical body is deposited. Two quite different laws and worlds are the base of both these bodies. The body belongs to the earth, the soul belongs to the astral. The upper spiritual man who lives in the body receives it when it enters into the world, and the earth takes this body away with it. It is, if I in earthland dwell in a leasehold. The leasehold is subject to earth police and its laws. So it is with the earth body. Through the earth body, man is able to look towards the external. This looking towards the external is a condition of knowledge. And with that, birth and death is inseparable with the arising of knowledge. The Bible proves that with the words, "Your eyes will become open and you will be able to distinguish the good and the evil." So, since the times of Lemuria, Manus was prepared. It was prepared to meet that which was developing itself in the lower realms. Through the senses, Manus draws into the physical body. Through Manus is death determined. Without Manus, there would be no death. That is the place where it says in the John Gospel, "Your fathers have eaten manna and have died of it." But in the bread of Jesus, one cannot die. Christ is that particular food which again brings the ether development. The Christ impulse represents the penetration of the Buddhi. Manus thus is a transition point which occurred when in Lemuria the ether body was led into the physical body. Buddhi is brought, however, through Jesus into the ether body, but it's brought from the inwards bringing. This principle of the enlivening from within, that is brought by Christianity. I am the life. As long as in the world there ruled the being bound to the physical body, the principle of heredity, man has no possibility to gaze out beyond death. However, that occurs in the moment when his life body, his ether body, from inwards out towards the outside, can be animated through Buddhi, where Manus takes up Buddhi. Moses can thus be considered the messenger for Manus. Christ is the messenger for Buddhi. The initiate on this stage can be outside his body. Now, let us ask ourselves one thing. A people was made to be the carrier of Manus development. The whole of the folk consciousness is condensed into the one initiate. When the Jewish people approached the point of doing away with its mission, the Lord said, when the Jewish people was on the point of forfeiting their mission, the Lord said to Moses, I will crush down all the others, meaning the Jews. You, however, Moses, I will make to a great people. This place has to be taken word for word. It is a higher initiation of Moses. With that, Moses will so carry over his mission that he is made to become an initiate with a folk consciousness. Now, a further significant circumstance is the role which the blood plays in the manus process, because in the blood, naturally, the higher process must reflect itself in the blood. Moses takes the blood sacrifice and sprinkles it over the people. That is the sign for the truth of the covenant through the blood relationship. When Manus has taken up the blood and also the Budi, then we understand the place where it says in the John Gospel, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood, there he remains in me and I in him. If Christ is to be able to work upon the mankind, so this mankind must be identical with him in a blood identity. Man, if Christ is to implant the Budi in him, man must receive the Christ blood in the Last Supper. Now we have to consider another cosmic truth. The world is very complicated. The beings which today are stones, plants, animals, they stand in a close connection with man. Man is not the latest creature of creation, but he is the earliest. If we want to disregard the earlier earth incorporations in order to occupy ourselves with the human being. And here is a schematic survey. 1. Saturn, the first condition of the earth, which at that time condensed itself to an ether earth, consisted actually of pure ether human bodies and can be compared in a picture way with the form of a great blackberry. Man was at that time a quite spiritualized being, absolutely only with a ether body. The next condition consists in the fact that the ether human beings separate, as it were, into two streams. One, an uprising stream, and other a descending stream. You have the arising of animals. 3. Man, animal, plant. 4. Man, animal, plant, stone. Now every time when a new member of the being attaches itself, then man develops in himself another natural anlage, another nature anlage, addition. 1. mineral development, the Anlager to the Ego. Anlager means disposition, construction, predisposition. The Anlager to the Ego. Two, plant development, ether body. Three, animal development, astral body. Note here, he says here, the mineral development is the Anlager to the Ego. I wonder if what's involved here might be that in the first stage, the mineral development of the Saturn stage, that laid the basis for the physical body, and the physical body enables the Ego Anlager. I don't know, I'm just speculating here. But Rudolf Steiner doesn't say, he says, one, mineral development, he doesn't say physical body, but one, mineral development, ego predisposition. Two, plant development, ether body. Three, animal development, astral body. In the moment when the animal diverts itself away, diverges, the animal element diverges, there arises in human being the astral perception. In the moment when the plant diverges, there arises the etheric growth aspect. In the moment where the stones divert themselves, the mineral kingdom, there the microcosm forms bones. Hence the correspondings and the analogies between the body organization and the earth object. It could be lion, belladonna, or asbestos. Don't know why he mentions that. Paracelsus says, outside in the earth world, there are pure letters. Man is the putting together. Man is the word that's put together out of these letters. The whole of nature is man spread out. In man, the word is formed. Now, I'd be able to notice now that when you get these things, these are just notes that somebody took at these lectures, so perhaps that might be disconnected, but it's important at least to have these notes anyway. Now, those streams of evolution which have been driven away from the human being did not all remain without further development. On the contrary, they have achieved certain evolutionary goals even much earlier than man, who was not specialized. For example, he is preparing the future hardness of the human body. Whereas the wooden plants have a long time ago achieved it, the hardness in its inferior way. Also, certain poisons represent a development, an anticipating of future development, which man will achieve. Poison, which is met in a plant, man once upon a time had in himself. If man would have developed himself in the same sense as these substances, then he would have been able to separate, for example, arsenic out of himself. As wood, just as wood, just as poison, so is, you can say, that wine is a plant juice which has hurried forward in development. It's progressed forward in development more than the human. That one can still more exactly consider. Wine, the juice which flows through the vine, is a one-sided development of the blood. What the blood breathes produces carbon dioxide, alcohol. Alcohol is, so to say, the future blood. The outbreathed carbon dioxide of the... No, the present blood relates itself to the... No, the carbon dioxide there, that which is carbon dioxide, The plant juice breathing out carbon dioxide compares itself to the present blood as compared to a future blood.
What the bloody hell is that mean?
The blood, when the blood breathes, it gives carbon dioxide. Now, the vine produces alcohol. Therefore, alcohol is, so to say, the future blood. Now comes this sentence, that the carbon dioxide outbreathing plant juice compares itself to the present blood as future blood. We'll work it out. Out of the cosmic knowledge, we experience the relationship between wine and blood. Christ has to say to wine about wine, "This is my blood," because Christ is a representative of the future mankind. His teaching itself is a living spring to which man develops himself up. Just consider the simile of the vine, of the wine of the human blood, and its tears. The simile of the change of water into wine. The vine represents an exception in development, a pre-something which jumps into the future, analogous to the anticipating hardening of wood. Just as today the plant changes its watery juice into wine, so man cannot do that today. However, later on, he will change his blood. It says in the Gospel of John, in the third day, there was a marriage at Cana in Galilee. Galilee equals El Goyim, the land of the mixtures who don't belong to the real race people. There in Galilee, the race mixture was stark, very strong. And so you get the separation of that which separates people. It was that place in Galilee that there occurred the marriage of the different blood. The mother Jesus is also there, just as she is later on the cross. Never in the John Gospel is she called Maria. On the contrary, the other two women under the cross are explicitly called Maria. And one of them is designated as Maria, as the sister of the mother of Jesus. So Jesus' mother is not Maria. Here ends this lecture. And now we come to the next lecture, the 4th of November, 1906. And now we come to the next lecture, the 4th of November, 1906. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying, yesterday we closed by attempting to throw a little light upon that which is told in the John Gospel about the marriage at Cana, and we have made specially emphasize the fact that the mother of Jesus also was there. John calls her here, as in other places where the mother of Jesus is mentioned, he doesn't call her Maria, just as little as John doesn't call himself, but only calls himself the disciple whom the Lord loved. We saw that with the marriage in Galilee was indicated the uniting of human being beyond the limits of the blood. In the cross, there stand the mother of Jesus and her sister Maria, the wife of Cleophas, and Maria of Magdalene. Thus, it can't assume that both sisters had the name Maria. Thus, the question arises, who was the mother of Jesus? Who was the father of Jesus? Both questions are important points
of our esoteric knowledge. Christ says to John, "See, there is your mother." To his mother he says, "See, there is your son." Today we want to build the building stones to a correct understanding of what follows. Let's remember that John, or better described the writer of the John Gospel, he was an initiate. That a real initiate really wrote this gospel, somebody to whom the heaven was open and who had exact knowledge of the astral and devashanic world. John also tells you how one can arrive at such a condition through the meditation of the first words of the John Gospel. One always lives, if one permits oneself to live these words in the soul, then they will become magic words through which one gradually arises up to the understanding of the John Gospel. John wants to say to us, if you want to go the Christian path, then you must, in the way in which I'm telling you here, lift yourself up to Devashan, and then there will appear to you all the deeds of Jesus and everything which occurred to him, as I'm going to tell it to you. The John Gospel is a life book which represents something which was experienced in one's own body. We cannot understand the Gospel of John until we consider them more than merely historical facts, but regard them as things which are seen by John with the higher capacity of sight. Marriage is also a real event, but the facts become symbols. The ordinary person sees this marriage with its miracle of the wine differently from an awakened person as John. For John, this is a prophetic thing for the whole future of mankind, for all that which is to occur through Christ. Now we live in the fifth main race. Before the fifth main race, you had the fourth main race, within which the events of Palestine occurs. Following the fifth main race, you have the sixth main race. That which occurred in Palestine falls approximately together with the arising of the fifth main race, but actually in the fourth sub-race, the Greek Latin. Out of the third sub-race, there proceeded the Israelite people. That was the Israelite people had to prepare its mission in Egypt and was gone out and went out of Egypt. Out of Egypt also Jesus went himself. Thus we have to distinguish three epochs, esoterically speaking, 3 days of creation. On the third day, there was a marriage at Cana. The writer of the John Gospel sees that which will occur in the future in the sixth race. The marriage of Manus, which expresses itself in the law, with Budi, which is grace. Here you have the great marriage of the whole monastic element with Budi. Then could only first appear if the task of Christianity has completely been fulfilled. The person who doesn't leave father and mother and brother and sister for my sake cannot be my disciple. That means from all of the narrow communities, there must be developed a love, a universal human love, of which that which is blood-related must develop up to that which is spirit-related. So we have in the marriage of Cana that symbolized which shall occur in the future. Hence, when it says, "And on the third day, that is not accidental, but it has to be taken as a cosmic day. Every number, every word, which is in the John Gospel, has very high significance. One must actually be amazed when most of the theologians regard Jehovah as the father of Christ. In the Gospel of Luke it says clearly where the archangel Gabriel, Maria Sophia, announces the birth of Jesus to Maria Sophia. He said, the archangel Gabriel says, "Do not fear, you have found grace with God. The Holy Spirit will come over you, and the power of the highest will overshadow you." And nowhere stands anything else but that. Thus the Father of Jesus is not Jehovah, but the Holy Spirit. That corresponds not only merely to the John Gospel, but to an ancient tradition. Christ says, "I and the Father are one." That means I and the Holy Spirit are one. Now you have the question, who was the mother of Jesus? In order to know that, you have to have knowledge of the nature of initiation. That will only be clear that we have here to deal with processes in the higher worlds. Hence, we are preparing ourselves through this for an understanding of the John Gospel from the 13th chapter onwards. Now here, we want to insert the teaching of initiation in a sort of expanded way, because not merely are we dealing here with the John Gospel, but we're dealing here with the whole of theosophy. The teaching of initiation teaches us to know the mother of Jesus, and what she is, what the mother of Jesus is, and what the Holy Spirit is. There today dominates many errors, as if there was only one path to initiation, but that's not correct. The truth, finally, is the same thing when you look at it from the top of the mountain, but there are different ways to get up to the top. Which way you want to, which you adopt, that depends upon where you're standing at the foot of the mountain. The mountain was always the expression for a rising up. As, for example, the top of the mountain occurred in the feeding of the 5,000. There are three different ways of initiation which correspond to the sub-races of our main race. The sub-races do not separate themselves completely, but they live for a long time side by side. The difference is inwardly much more than externally. For example, an Indian today can, it's much easier for an Indian today to sink down into his sympathetic nervous system by cutting off his thinking. If a European wants to go, particularly a man, wants to go along the Oriental path, so he needs, in order to enable his physical to do it, he has to take in strong medicaments who are able to separate his body state, his bone status, and his bodily composition. He has to take in medicaments if he wants to follow the Oriental path. And this could not occur without lasting damage. And so you don't advise a European to follow that path. Initiation is a complete transformation of one's inner nature. For the present European, the best path is the Rosicrucian path, which was fostered since the 14th century. The three paths of initiation are as follows: the Indian Oriental path, the Indian Oriental yoga path, the Christian Gnostic path, which was valid to the 15th century, then the Christian Rosicrucian path, which is valid since the 15th century. The first path is not suitable for Europeans. The second path is adapted for people of the middle zones. It is for us okay. But the Rosicrucian path, which was inserted from the 14th century, is much better. The Christian Gnostic path truly can bring single people the truth, but the student will not be in a position to lead it through and remain within the modern living, and to give answers on the manifold objections which can be put against it by present science and culture, as it is possible to do today with the help of the Rosicrucian path. The Oriental Yoga path knows a series of stages in which one must prepare oneself. The seven stages can be exercised one by the side of the other, but man must place himself strongly under the leader of a so-called guru, who knows a great deal about the conditions relating to inner development. The path of Indian immediately goes up into the astral world. In the beginning, the student is very helpless, hence the strong subjection under the guru, because he is able to correct things that will occur. Now, the first stage is Yama. That is the astral world. In the physical world, the student can correct himself in all his perceptions and assertions, his perceptions and his ideas. The physical world can correct him. However, that is not possible in the astral world. There, impressions storm upon him in pictures and colors, in forms and structures, which are in a continuously interchange and incessant movement. To that you have the adds that which one's own soul thinks and wills, which also become beings, and which then the student is not able to distinguish his own astral nature from the objective astral nature. In order to that, he must give himself the direction to steer himself in the astral world. He must give his own direction from inwards out, from his own inward being, in order to stand securely. Because how does this world appear? In the case of a plant, you get something rising up like a lilac flame. The qualities of things separate themselves in colors. They lift themselves up from things. The astral space is filled from weaving here and there colors, properties, qualities, sounds. These colors and sounds must go towards astral beings and fill them out. For example, some kind of elementary spirit can fill out these things and appear in an illuminating yellow color. In order to distinguish all these things and to know what the situation really is, you have to have security. In the moment now when these elementary spirits want to lead you, then there appear strong forces in the inner nature of the human being. The actual soul of the human being expresses itself, and this actual soul drives the human being wherever the soul wants to go. In order to direct the helpless student, he must live in the soul of his guru. He must see with the eyes of his guru, hence the necessity for the strong authority of the guru. Everything which he undertakes, he has to ask the guru. If he wants to buy a house, he has to ask everything the guru. Is completely subject to the guru. With the exercise of Yama, man must be abstemious. He must have abstention. the under that, the das Unterlassen, abstention. Under this, the Indian understands he mustn't kill, he mustn't steal, he mustn't lie, he mustn't exaggerate, he mustn't desire things. That appears to be easy, but this for the European is immensely difficult, because you can't, in the present life and cultural conditions of Europe today, that's impossible to fulfill these conditions of yama. For example, with every breath of air, he is causing death if he is not able to regulate his breathing. He has his money in his bank. Money in the bank can be used for certain enterprises, but he doesn't know what is done with his money. So the concept, it's very important for anything we do not to damage other people. The only possibility of partly adhering to these conditions is to be always without desires and requirements. So that's the first stage, which is called yama. Now we have the second stage, niyama. That describes the observation of the cult symbols. The Indian training demands strongly that the student participates in ceremonies, subjects himself to certain rituals. With that, they're in picture. In these ceremonials and rituals, there's picture in a picture form. There is presented that which one inwardly passes through. This is necessary. Such a ritual, for example, is in the Christian sacrament, with its sacrament of the Mass, sacrifice of the Mass, brought to expression in its four parts. This is the expression for the ancient mysterium, and consists out of 1, the Evangelium, the proclamation; 2, the sacrifice of the lower self; 3, the transformation into the higher self, the communion. Three, the transformation into the higher self. So you have, first you have the gospel, then you have the sacrificing of the lower self, then you have the transformation into the higher self, then you have the communion, which is the union with the divine. What occurs on the astral plane occurs there in pictures on the physical plane. In order that one can see it in pictures, that has significance. You take up the picture, and then in one night the student can take up the astral world, and that will become a force in him. You regard in pictures, you regard what you see in pictures, something which is depicted of what shall occur on the higher planes. So that's the second stage, niyama. First stage, yama. Second stage, niyama. Now the third stage is asana. That deals with the correct bodily position. There are powerful streams continuously going from the east to the west through the world and through the human body. And these ether streams have an important influence upon the human being. That was known very much in ancient India as to how much the student depends upon the correct body position. We have in the plant the picture of that which shows ourselves in the construction of the man, only in a reversed way. What corresponds to the human head, that is underneath in the root, in the root. But the proper organs of propagation holds themselves in the plant towards the sun. The animal is in the waagrecht, or the horizontal position, towards the sun and the earth axis. And man is a reverse plant, upright. And these positions are given in the cross. Hence the sentence, The world soul is crucified on the world body. Every organ is subject to definite streams which must be eingehalten. Towards the east, it's different than towards the west. The Indian yoga student has therefore to occupy a definite position. Now we come to the fourth stage, that is pranayama. That is the teaching of rhythmical breathing. The ordinary breathing process causes a death with the air which is breathed out. So you have man and animal breathe out carbon dioxide, breathe in oxygen. The plant breathes out oxygen, breathes in carbon dioxide, and out of the carbon it builds up its body. Here is the cycle between the animal and plant life, between man, animal, and plant. Man breathes in oxygen, and with that he builds his body, his correct blood properly. The rhythmic breathing process must be of such a nature where gradually changes the death process, which overcomes that which as a coal or carbon lies in the earth as the corpse of plants. We ought to consider the human corpse and the plant corpse as a totality. The same process which today man exercises with the help of the plant in the breathing in and the out breathing, this building up which the plant does, man will himself do in the future. When man will be in a position out of carbon to build up his own body, then he has achieved a future condition. That is the occult expression for carbon, coal, the stone of the wise. Those who know Rosicrucianism, they know what the significance of the fact is that man will build himself up out of carbon. He will build up a transparent body, just as diamonds are formed out of coal, carbon. That will occur. In the future, man will be in a position of his blue blood through the lymph glands, which then will play a very important part in order to transform a building up organ. And with that, he will utilize the red blood to configurate, to form his body. The pineal gland, the tearful drusa, the pineal gland will be in the future an interior apparatus for the transformation of the used up blood into usable blood. Very strongly connected with this is the rhythmic making of the breathing. The breathing process hence conceals in itself the future transformation of the human organism. In the moment where man works down into his lower bodies, then he rises up to the higher planes. Now we come to the fifth stage, the pratyahara. There man will be in a position of inwardly living, or purely in interior of his soul. He must be able to have ideas in him which are completely independent of the external world. The ideal of meditation is to become blind and deaf for his environment. So this is the fifth stage of the pratyahara. He's blind and deaf for his environment. Now we come to the sixth stage, is dharana. Man will be completely master within his world of concepts, so the man can have no impressions other than those which he wants. Then he can, out of a series of concepts, take out one, and then live for a long time with this one concept. Then one calls this process in which he remains resting with whole consciousness, dhyana. See, dharana, in dharana, you experience dhyana, and this dhyana is the concentration on one concept. If that is reached, then one must able to let this concept fall away, nevertheless become conscious with your whole soul. One retains the form of Vorstellen without a content. If one achieves this, if the student achieves this, then there is the moment when the content of the spiritual world can stream into him. And so with that, we can reach the seventh stage, the stage of Samadhi. I believe this is the best account I've ever come across of the seven stages of the yoga stages. The first yama, the second niyama, the third asana, the fourth pranayama, the fifth pratyahara, the sixth dharana, the seventh samadhi. Now, through this Indian yoga student, one arrives in occult development to the same stage which one passes through the Christian Gnostic path. Also, in this Christian Gnostic path, you distinguish seven stations. First stage, the washing of the feet. The student, through a long period of time, has developed himself in himself a definite feeling, and this feeling has to live in his soul. It must be clear to him that the law exists, that there can be no rising up of one without a pushing down of the other. For one initiate, there exists so and so many criminals. Hence, if one arrives at more knowledge, it's his first duty to stoop down and to try to draw other people up, lift the other people up. Just as it is with the human being, so it is also in the world of nature. The plant had to speak to the earth. You, in quite humility, the plant has to say to the earth, "You lifeless earth, that must be the fundamental feeling of the student. I bow down to you, you lifeless earth, because it is you that I thank for my existence." Christ himself gives us in the washing of a feet an example for the fact, insofar as he leads before our eyes the feeling of the innermost humility. If the student forms for himself this feeling in himself, then there occur in him two experiences, an external symptom and an inner astral experience. The external symptom is that the student has the quite definite feeling as if water is umspooling round his feet. He perceives the condition of a foot washing externally. Now inwardly, the Christian student experiences inwardly the picture as a real vision inwardly. The second stage is the whipping. There appear to this man pains which want to press him down. He must say to himself, "You must learn to carry yourself upright, even though you have this whipping on you. And if you exercise this for long enough time, that people are being whipping you all the time, and you still nevertheless you stand upright, then there appear two symptoms: the external symptom of sticking pains in your whole body just as you're being whipped. That's a proof for the fact that the exercise has worked into the ether body. Now, the inner astral experience is the picture of the Geißelung, or of the scourging. The corresponding chapters of the Gospel of John Gospel are those from the 13th chapter onwards. So we have first the washing of the feet, the second is the scourging, the third is the crowning of thorns. This content of feeling is that of being gespottet, being mocked, and that which you consider to be the holy thing is pulled down. Nevertheless, you must stand upright. The external symptom of this are headaches which last for weeks. And inwardly, you get the astral picture of one's own crowning with thorns. And the fourth is the carrying of the cross and the crucifixion. The feeling is the same, that you carry your body as a piece of wood. It's so foreign to you as a foreign body must be. Your own personality must completely disappear. You must become free from your body, quite free the student must be. And when you experience this, you're carrying your body as if something external to you, then you will inwardly experience the picture of the crucifixion. And externally there will appear on your own body the stigmata at the places where the wounds of Christ. The side wound will appear on the right side of the breast. Now we come to the fifth stage, called the mystical death. This is a high experience. It's a very high stage, and the experience is very, very significant. The cognition occurs that the perception of all the things we had, that was all illusion. A frightful darkness pours itself over into space. The whole world sinks down. One learns to know only one thing, the true configuration of all the evil, all the pains and the suffering of this world. Here is the descent to hell. One has to experience this very exhaustively. Then comes the moment where the curtain tears itself asunder, and one now sees a new form of the world. One sees the world from the other side. Now we have stage six, is the placing in the grave. Everything in the world is for the student so as if the whole world belongs to his own body. He becomes one with the earth. The whole earth becomes his own body, which he has. One is placed in the earth, and the earth covers one up. At the same time, one gets always an astral picture of this. And seven, you have the resurrection and ascension. That's the seventh stage. This rising up, this stage, because of its grandeur, can no longer be spoken and described with words of the human language. Here are the seven stages of the Christian path, what he calls the Christian Gnostic path described. I don't know why he calls it the Christian Gnostic path, because the term Gnosticism meant something else to me always. But he always calls it the Christian Gnostic path. And here we have the seven stages here indicated, but actually he has a different from the seven stages are different here than from somewhere else. A slight difference. Now Rudolf Steiner says, we will give you a diagrammatically the third kind of initiation, the Christian Rosicrucian path, which is the most adaptable for the modern human being. This Rosicrucian path also has seven stages: the first, study; the second, imagination; the third, learning the occult script; the fourth is life rhythm; The fifth is the correspondence of the microcosm and the macrocosm. The sixth is a contemplation, which is an inner religious aspect of the macrocosm. And the seventh is the God-blessedness. Here's a third path to reach the top of the mountain. A real experience which you find described in the John Gospel is the descent of the Spirit as the dove upon Jesus. With that is at the same time meant the higher birth of Jesus, where that is received which one calls the Son of Man. Verse 18, chapter 1, contains something very mysterious when it says, God, no one has up to now looked upon God with eyes. The once-born Son, which was in the inner being of the Cosmic Father, he has become the leader to this kind of seeing. This has to be taken word for word. The John Gospel contains the astral, the writing down of the deposit of the astral writing. You know, on the astral plane, there shows itself everything reversed, and you must learn how to read things reversed. And here ends the lecture.